You are tuned in to Ekne-Kron, a Death to the World podcast, done in conjunction with St. Timothy Orthodox Church in Lompoc, California. Recordings, lectures, and readings to inspire truth-seeking and soul-searching amidst a modern age of nihilism and despair.
Today we are going to talk about two different saints whom we mentioned last week. But I was so caught up in reading the life of St. Anthony that I didn't get to the other saint. Because there's so much about St. Anthony's life that pertains to everything that we're going to be talking about in this course. And I figured since we don't have an exact schedule like we usually do, that I'll just bump St. Pachomios and St. Makarios to next week. As you remember from last week, St. Anthony the Great is called the father of monks, and he is the first anchorite, which means like a desert dweller hermit. He's the first one in our tradition that started this road to the monastic life. So a lot of what we do in monasteries is attributed to him. That's why he's called the father of monks. And we'll see, you know, more and more why he's called this father of monks. But his life is very, very important to us. If you've never read his life before, it's absolutely necessary in the Christian life to read his life. It's written by St. Athanasius the Great, his disciple, and it is only about 80 pages long. You know, you can read it in a few hours, but it is packed with just a lot of wisdom and both really kind of scary instances in his life, his teachings, and some really beautiful things that happened in his life. And we'll go over some of those. But like with all of these classes, nothing is going to be as profound as actually reading the works, you know? In these courses, we're just skimming over things and kind of getting the cliff notes of things, if you will. So I decided to take the freedom to give this whole class to St. Anthony the Great because of those things, because he's so important to us. And we'll see throughout this course that many monks and monasteries hearken back to his life. You know, people from the West, like St. John Cassian, will go back to Egypt, right, and try to revive this tradition of Anthony and things like that. So we'll see him over and over again. Elder Ephrem of Arizona, when he came here from Greece to establish monasteries, his main hub of a monastery was St. Anthony's in Arizona, right? So he's very, very important, even to monks today. So Anthony the Great was born in Koma, which is in Lower Egypt, in 251. Right? This is before the Edict of Milan. It's before Constantine, before the Council of Nicaea, to wealthy Christian parents. As a young boy, he didn't take interest in learning to read, and he didn't know how to read for his entire life. All of the works that we have of him are all things that he spoke, and they were written down by a scribe and sent out. You know, we have about 7 letters written by St. Anthony the Great that are preserved to this day, and some other works of his through his other disciples, but these were all penned down by a scribe. He had never learned how to read or write his whole life. He didn't even like to play with other children. He liked to stay at home. He desired to spend his time working for his parents in and around the house, just like the prophet Jacob did with his father and his mother. And so he kind of emulated this very simple and, I guess you would say, kind of infantile way of living, not in a derogatory sense, but because it was just so pure. The way that he lived and wanted to serve his family. When he was about 18 or 20 years old, Anthony's parents died suddenly and left him with wealth and much land and a sister whom he had to look after as a young man. This happened tragically. St. Athanasius doesn't explain really how this happened, if one died one after another, if it was a sickness or what it was, but nevertheless, at a very early age, he was orphaned as a young man and then left with his sister in his care. But they had a lot of land and a lot of wealth. About 6 months later, on his way to church, he was examining himself before Holy Communion. And he reflected on the lives of the apostles and their calling, namely to give everything up in order to follow Jesus Christ, right? They left their nets behind, they left their whole lives behind, and they gave everything to follow Jesus Christ. And so he was contemplating this. And this was, I guess, something that was, you know, made his heart ready to receive the words that he would hear in the Holy Gospel that was being read at that Divine Liturgy, which is from the Gospel of Matthew. It's also in the Gospel of Luke. But it was read to the rich man, the Lord's words to the rich man: if thou wouldst be perfect, go and sell all of that you have. Or in this translation, if thou wouldst be perfect, go and sell that thou hast and give to the poor. Come and follow me, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven. Right, so this really struck his heart, and he had inherited this great wealth and this great sum of land, but yet the words of the Savior really pierced his soul. And so he lived with this in his as his kind of mode of being for the rest of his life after this. Immediately leaving the church, he distributed all that he had. It was about some 300 acres of fertile lands and riches in Egypt. And he gave it to the poor villagers, neighboring villagers. And he also sold some of his goods that can be transported out of his home. And he sold them, and he took that money for the sake of his own sister, so that he can care for his own sister. But everything else that was extra, he gave off to the poor. He sought a reputable and faithful virgins, houses of virgins. This was something that was common in the early Christian days, that you had homes of virgins. We even see this in the Acts of the Apostles, women who devoted themselves in virginity to the serving of the church. They're basically like the early convents of the time. And so Anthony sought out a good and reputable place, a convent, if you will, early convent, to put his sister into for her upbringing. It doesn't really say her name, and it doesn't ever say in his life how old she was, like if she was 2 years younger than him or 5 years younger than him, I'm not sure exactly. But nevertheless, he gave her into one of these homes in order for her to be raised with these virgins in a pious way. And he wanted to venture into the distant desert, but there were no monks doing this at the time. This wasn't a practice. The practice at the time of St. Anthony were basically devoted men who lived as monks outside of their own village, right? So they would live on the outskirts of the village. They would live in solitude. They would live in asceticism, but they weren't ever really venturing far into the desert to be completely alone on their own, right? So Anthony, emulating the life of these men, wanted to live like them and began to live like them first around his own home and his own village. And then he started going out to neighboring villages and learning from different men that were living in asceticism around those villages, you know, as he heard about them. So he'd hear about one virtuous man, he would travel there and he would stay with him for a while. Then he heard about another one, he'd go to another village and stay with him for a while. And he kind of traveled around doing this and trying to take everything that he could, right? So he began to soar in virtue, imitating righteous ascetics, working and praying unceasingly in secret. Right? He had nothing, but committed everything that was read to memory, or read nothing, and but committed everything that was read to memory, which served him until the end of his life. So although St. Anthony could not read, he had such a purified mind that he was able to remember entireties of scripture and the works of ascetics that were read to him throughout his whole life. And he died at 105. So he was able to recollect these things even from his youth all the way until his old age. And so he was absolutely brilliant. I mean, when you read the life of Saint Anthony by Athanasius and you read his letters, they are just absolute, and the footnotes for scripture are just phenomenal. I mean, the way that he speaks using the words of Paul and the words of the Lord and the words of the Old Testament and things like that over and over and over again, just in his everyday speech, you know, and his letters and his addresses to his monks and things like that. So absolutely brilliant and illumined mind, right? This wasn't just by him being a very smart guy or having a high IQ. It was because he had a purified mind and heart through his unceasing prayer and his purity, his spiritual purity. So he began to soar in virtue, imitating these righteous ascetics, and he took in everything as a bee gathers honey. Athanasius wrote of him during this period, and this is in the life of Saint Anthony the Great. All the quotes here in this teaching, by the way, and the handout are all from the life of Saint Anthony the Great by Athanasius. He said that Anthony subjected himself in sincerity to the good men whom he visited and learned thoroughly where each surpassed him in zeal and discipline. Right, so he would learn about somebody doing an ascetic work or surpassing him in one area, so he'd move to that area and live with him and learn from him. Right, he observed the graciousness of one, the unceasing prayer of another. He took knowledge of another's freedom from anger and another's loving kindness. He gave heed to one as he watched, another as he studied, one he admired for his endurance, another he admired for his fasting and sleeping on the ground. The meekness of one and the long-suffering of another he watched with care, while he took note of piety towards Christ and the mutual love which animated all. Thus filled, he returned to his own place of discipline, and henceforth would strive to unite the qualities of each, and was eager to show in himself the virtues of all, right? So just like a bee, he would go from flower to flower, from each ascetic to the next, and take everything that was good about that ascetic and try to apply it to himself, so that he would accumulate all of the virtues of the ascetics around him. But the devil, who hates and envies what is good, could not endure to see such a resolution in a youth. So he began to make war on Anthony, St. Athanasius says. Right? He was young. He was 18 or 20 at the time. And he wanted this pure life so badly. And he had such a resolution to purify his soul and live as a monk, that the devil wanted to especially attack and wage war on him. This is before he went out deep into the desert. This is still him living, surrounding the villages, living in his own place of solitude, but nevertheless not completely fleeing into the desert yet. And so the first attack from the devil was a confusion of thoughts. St. Athanasius says, to lead him away from the discipline, whispering to him the remembrance of his wealth, the care for his sister, the claims of kindred, the love of money, the love of glory, the various pleasures of the table, and the other relaxations of life, and at last the difficulty of virtue and the labor of it. He suggested also the infirmity of the body and the length of the time. In a word, he raised in his mind a great dust of debate, wishing to debar him from his settled purpose. But Anthony thwarted him and showed him weak. All right, so Anthony, he basically first set upon him with trying to divide his mind, right? Trying to raise up within him questions and thoughts, right? And in this life of St. Anthony, we see, when we talked about sin, how sin begins in these past lectures, we talked about how it begins with the provoking of thoughts, right? So this is what I mean about the life of St. Anthony the Great. When we read into it, we see the spiritual disciplines of the church, right? Because right here, we're seeing it laid out already in the life of St. Anthony, right? Before Constantine, before the establishment of huge monasteries and this kind of thing, we're already seeing the monks finding out the science of the spiritual life, if you will, right? And seeing how the devil first makes his attacks on the mind, scattering the mind, throwing out a cloud of, a dust of debate in the mind, to try to persuade Anthony through these thoughts and these debates back to his former life. Right. And Anthony thwarts them all because he has such a resolution to live this pious life. Failing to divert him from his purpose, the devil then began to attack him through the weakness of his youth. That is, through lustful incitements. St. Athanasius says, through the navel of his belly, right? And you hear about this in the lives of the Desert Fathers or in their writings. They talk about the attacks starting in the navel of the belly. And that is all. That is from where the passions, if you will, we feel them beginning, whether it's rage, anger, lust. This is where they're talking about, like, when we feel that like butterfly-ish or that emotions rise up, that kind of thing. It's within the navel of the belly. And so that's where he began to attack him, especially through these lustful incitements, because he was a young man. This attack went on day and night, and St. Athanasius says that it was even apparent to those who were visiting Anthony at the time that he was being constantly put in contest by the devil. It was apparent to people who visited him he was waging this war with the devil. And Athanasius writes, the one would suggest foul thoughts and the other, Anthony, right? So he says the one, the devil, would suggest foul thoughts and the other, Anthony, would counter them with prayers. The one, the devil, would fire him with lust and the other, Anthony, the one who would seem to blush, fortify his body with faith, prayers, and fasting. The devil, unhappy, one night took upon him the shape of a woman and imitated all her acts simply to beguile Anthony. But he, his mind filled with Christ and the nobility inspired by him, and considering the spirituality of the soul, quenched the coal of the other's deceit. Again, the enemy suggested the ease of pleasure. But he, like a man filled with rage and grief, turned his thoughts to the threatened fire and the gnawing worm, and setting these in array against his adversary, passed through the temptation unscathed, right? So we read from the suggestions of the fathers to remember death and to remember hell. We're seeing it here in the life of St. Anthony. It is how he was able to overcome the demon of lust, right? One of the ways in which he was able to do so is to remember the unquenchable fire, the threatening fire, and the gnawing worm that never sleeps. All this was a source of shame for his foe, so he put the devil to shame. For he, deeming himself like God, was now mocked by a young man, right? And I love these words that Athanasius uses about Anthony, because the devil is so prideful and so pompous, and yet he is being beaten and thwarted and cast out by this young man. And he who boasted himself against flesh and blood was being put to flight by a man in the flesh. So Anthony is victorious again over the devil in this attack on him. It lasts for a long time in his life, and yet he prevails in the end by his steadfastness and his love toward God and his unceasing prayer and the remembrance of death. Being cast out, St. Athanasius says, of Anthony's heart, casting the devil out of his heart, the demon of lust appeared to him as a blackened boy. Right? So he appeared to him as this small, like young child that was all black and hideous. And he said, the devil said, many I have deceived. This is the demon of lust talking to Anthony. Many I have deceived, many I cast down, but now attacking thee and thy labors, as I had many others, I proved weak. When St. Anthony asked, who art thou who speakest with us with me? He answered with a lamentable voice, the demon answers Anthony, saying, I am the friend of whoredom. I have taken upon me incitements which lead it to which lead to it against the young. I am called the spirit of lust. How many I have deceived who wish to live soberly. How many are the chaste whom by my incitements I have overpersuaded. I am he on account of whom also the prophet reproves those who have fallen, saying, ye have been caused to err by the spirit of whoredom. For by me they have been tripped up. I am he who has so often troubled thee, and have so often been overthrown by thee. But Anthony, having given thanks to the Lord with good courage, said to him, thou art very despicable then, for thou art black-hearted and weak as a child. Henceforth I shall have no trouble from thee, for the Lord is my helper, and I shall look down upon mine enemies. Having heard this, the black one straightway fled, shuddering at the words and dreading any longer even to come near the man. Right? So the demons, so incredibly prideful, don't even want to be around Anthony because of how courageous and bold he is in warfare. They can't stand to be humbled by him, by being beaten and being talked to this way, right? He says, you're very despicable. You have appeared just like as your heart is, because you're black, right? And you have appeared just like a child because you are weak, right? And anybody who knows the fight against the demon of lust, and any of who have read the ascetic literature against the demon, like when monastics strive against the demon of lust, this demon is very strong, right? And it will come against a person for a very long time sometimes. You know, some of our ascetics of like modern days, for instance, would not go to sleep because they did not want to be tempted in their dreams. That so often occurred to them because the demon of lust began to wage war against them, right? So like Saint Joseph the Hesychast, for instance, he made a one-legged stool so he can sit down and pray, but if he ever started to drift off to sleep, he would fall and he would wake himself back up again, right? It's why so many of the young monks would do those things. And you hear about like the life of Saint John Chrysostom and some other ones where they chained themselves up in caves so they wouldn't fall asleep, right? Because they wanted to fight against this demon who is waging war against them in their own sleep, through their own thoughts, right? And so, but here we see in the life of Saint Anthony, he calls him weak. You know, he calls him weak and he calls him a child. And the demon can't take that. He's boasting here how many people he has basically thrown into hell, right? I am the cause of all these people going to hell. And I can boast more than any other demon, basically is what he's saying here, of bringing souls into hell, right? But you as a young man, I've been overcome by so many times. So these sorts of attacks were just the beginning of Anthony's tests, just the very beginning. This is the very beginning of his life as an ascetic. But he endured every trial and weathered every storm that was set upon him, revealing the Savior's work in Anthony, who condemned sin in the flesh, that the ordinance of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. So Anthony never relaxed his asceticism, but he took it up all the more because he knew the devil was a roaring lion seeking to devour him, and he knew that he needed to be strong in the day of contest when the devil would come and unleash his anger against him. And indeed, the devil used all of his cunning to tempt him even more, even more. So after this, Anthony flees further into the desert. After these trials in the very beginning, he flees further in the desert, and this is the first time that anybody has ever done that before. And there's all these accounts written by Athanasius about this time, this trial that he had, and the first trials of him going into the desert. But one of them, for instance, was the devil would lay gold in the desert as a mirage, as a, you know, an apparition to try to tempt him. You know, to pick it up or to entice him to go back, right? He would come upon him and say, you know, cease from thy many labors, please. You're going to make yourself sick, right? He would appear to him as a monk. He would appear to him as an angel. He would appear to him as a woman. He would appear to him in all different sorts of ways to try to tempt him not to go further into the desert. And as we talked about last week, remember, these saints did not just go into the desert to find a calm place and to be alone. St. Anthony went into the desert specifically for this purpose, to thwart the devil and to populate the desert later by his prayers with monks that would live there, right? And cultivate a pure life there. And, you know, last week we talked about how monasticism became the living martyrdom of the Christian heritage, right? Martyrs weren't being slain and killed anymore. So many men and women went out into the desert and became martyrs of the conscience. They became martyrs, spiritual martyrs in their monasteries, and they lived a very bold life, confessing the faith very boldly. But at St. Anthony's time, martyrs were still being made, right? And so even though martyrs were still being made by blood, he went out to be this spiritual martyr and enter into this contest with the devil in the desert. So the devil appears to him in many ways. He uses all sorts of beguilements to try to entice Anthony back to the cities. And it doesn't work. Every time it doesn't work, because he has such a resolution to stay there. And Anthony, he kept the following ascetic practices when he went into the desert, and he kind of made his own solitary abode in the desert. To pray unceasingly, and he even uses the words of St. Paul to pray unceasingly, right? This is not some new Christian, the Jesus prayer on the prayer rope and this kind of stuff is not a new Christian practice. It's been developed upon a bit, but it's not a new Christian practice to try to pray with the heart unceasingly. And so we see it in the life of even of St. Anthony here, to pray unceasingly and to keep regular vigil without sleep. St. Athanasius says that he would not sleep during one night. Sometimes he would sleep not for two nights in a row. And many times, Athanasius says that he slept not three nights in a row, right? So he kept himself up praying at night. He only ate once a day and only after sunset, and sometimes once in 2 days, and often even once in 4 days. And his diet was only bread, salt, and water only. And St. Athanasius says, "Of flesh and wine it is superfluous for us to speak, since no such thing was found with the other earnest men." Right? So he says these things did not even touch his mouth. Only bread, salt, and water only. And he kept his mind, and he deprived his body of any luxury and committed it to labor, not even giving himself a mat for sleep. So he slept on the bare ground. He would weave baskets and do other sorts of work, which sometimes he would be able to sell for some money to buy his loaves. So this was the ascetics would do back in that time. And you read about it in the lives of the Evergetinos, you know, the sayings of the desert fathers and things. You find this a lot, where they would weave baskets of palm branches or something like that that they would find in the desert. They would bring them to the cities. They would sell them. They would buy a certain amount of loaves of bread, and they would go back out into the desert, and they would continue their work in the desert, right? So this is how they were able to sustain themselves and their ascetic practices. So they would go and do this so that they could have some bread to eat while they were out in the desert. And he kept his mind in a constant state of the present. You know, this is very important in the life of St. Anthony. He did not account it important, if you will, to dwell on anything in the past, nor much on things in the future, but he kept his mind in a constant state of being present, and he measured his life always in comparison to the prophet Elijah. He said that a monk ought to look at the prophet Elijah's life like a mirror and be able to see himself in it. So at a certain time, Anthony departed from his place of struggle, and he entered in contest among the tombs. So he left his place of struggle in the desert. He went to dwell within the tombs outside of a village. And he asked for his acquaintances to shut him up inside of a tomb so that he can pray inside of a tomb. It was not like a coffin where you're just your body fits. It's an actual tomb, right, where many bodies would be put. And so he asked his acquaintances to seal him up inside of this tomb and to only bring him bread, salt, and water at a certain, intervals of time. And so the devils took out all of their rage on the ascetic while he was there, and he was beaten within inches of his life. This, not only did the desert a place in which demons dwell, but the tombs were a place where the demons dwell. We know this even from the Gospels, right? The man who was possessed outside of the land of the Gadarenes, or in the land of the Gadarenes, he dwelt among the tombs, right? So Anthony went to these places on purpose because he knew this is where he would enter into spiritual contest, right? It wasn't just like a cool solitary place to be sealed inside of a tomb where nobody could talk to you. No, he went there specifically to fight the devils that existed and dwelt in these places. So he goes to the tombs. He begins a life of asceticism within this tomb, and the devils appear to him and physically beat him within inches of his life. And when one of his acquaintances comes back to bring him food, he sees Anthony on the floor, not moving. He thinks he's dead. So he gets someone else, and they carry him back to a village, and they actually put him inside of the church to start reading the Psalms over him for his funeral, right? And so Anthony's lifeless, not moving. They bring him into the church, but during this vigil, while a few people had fallen asleep or were not around, Anthony wakes up. He is not able to move, but he motions with his head for his acquaintance to come over to him, and he tells him to put him back. Put me back in the tomb, right? So they pick him up and they put him back in the tomb, and he asks them to seal it again, and they seal him in there. And being shut again in the tomb, this is what he says. And this is like throughout his life, he's so bold to the devils. He says, "Here I am, Antony. I flee not from your stripes, for even if you inflict more, nothing shall separate me from the love of Christ." And then he's saying, "Though a camp be set against me, my heart shall not be afraid." And so you see the way in which he talks, it resembles the way in which the martyrs talked to the emperors, right? When they went into contest for their own blood. So the devils became enraged at this mockery of them and began to appear as vicious creatures that wanted to attack him. Anthony was firm in soul and mocked them all the more. So they started to appear like as scorpions, as snakes, as panthers, as lions, all these kind of vicious creatures around him to try to frighten him. And they start trying to like make attacks on him, like a wolf, a coyote. The devils appear like this, and they start to try to make attacks on him. But none of them are able to touch him. And so Anthony says to them, he says, "If there had been any power in you, it would have sufficed had one of you come. But since the Lord hath made you weak, you attempt to terrify me by numbers. And a proof of your weakness is that you take the shapes of brute beasts." And again with boldness he said, "If you are able and have received power against me, delay not to attack. But if you are unable, why trouble me in vain? For faith in the Lord is a seal and a wall of safety to us." Right? So incredibly bold to them. And at this, they became so enraged, they start to fight themselves. So the demons turn against other demons because they're so enraged by being humiliated, and they can't stand being humbled because their pride is so incredibly pompous and so incredibly palpable that they turn against one another and they start to fight with one another. And at this, and they rushed upon him, as they're trying to rush upon him and turning against themselves, the uncreated light appeared and drove them back. So the uncreated light of God appears. The way that Athanasius describes it is like it was a great earthquake, and it seemed as if the roof of the tomb was lifted off and a great light shone down upon Anthony. And when Anthony asked God, "Where were you?" Right? So one of the first things he says is, where were you? You know, I was beaten within inches of my life. I had all of this going on. Where were you? Right? And the Lord spoke to him and said, Anthony, I was here, but I waited to see thy fight. Wherefore, since thou hast endured and hast not even worsened, I will ever be a succor to thee, and I will make thy name known everywhere. Right? So God put him to the test, allowed him to be tested. And this is one of the kind of monumental stories in St. Anthony's life. You see sometimes many icons will be painted of this trial and tribulation in general. Michelangelo, I think his first, Michelangelo Buonarroti, the Renaissance painter, his first painting was of this scene with Anthony being attacked on all sides and things like that. It's very popular in Christian art. And in our iconography and things like that. But he thwarts him, right? And many times we ask God, where were you? And it seems like God is not there. And we say, where were you? Well, Anthony didn't despair, right? He knew that God was there. He knew that the sign of the cross and the power of prayer would expel the devils anyways. But nevertheless, he asked God, where were you? Right? And it gives us a glimpse of what our Christian life is like. Sometimes we enter into struggle, things befall us, and we ask God, where were you? And this answer that he gives to Anthony is an answer that he gives to all of us. He waits sometimes, and he allows us to endure a trial and to see if we come out on the other side more shining and brilliant than if we never had that trial in our life, right? So it was a way to show himself to this saint in his life, but also a way to purify him so that his name would be known everywhere. And indeed, it is known everywhere. So after this time in the tombs, Anthony went deeper into the desert across the Nile and took up his abode in an abandoned fort. And he was fighting demons there for 20 years on his own in solitude. His food was 6 loaves of bread, which lasted for 1 year. And he received loaves let down from above twice in the year, Athanasius says. So manna from heaven was given to him twice in the year. It was kind of like the way that it's described in the life of St. Anthony, it was almost like a hole in the ground in this fort that St. Anthony barricaded himself inside of. And there was a spring of water already in there. So he shut himself inside of there with his 6 loaves of bread for the year. And that's where he stayed. He wouldn't allow visitors to see him. He wouldn't care if there was any passersby. He stayed within this place and he sealed himself up. It says, what does it say? It says something in St. Athanasius's description, something like, that he put himself kind of like in a chapel is not the right word, but it's almost like he preserved himself in this holy place, but it was just this hole in the ground, and that's where he lived. So these years were spent in complete solitude, barricaded himself, and after these years, the appearance of many who sought to live his way of life, they wrenched off the door. And pleaded with him to come out and lead them. So they did not want him to be stuck in solitude anymore. People would know where he was, and they would come to him, and they would receive counsel or advice from him, but he would not come out to see people, right? And sometimes people would come to him, and they would hear chanting, St. Anthony's chanting, within sight of the hole where he barricaded himself. Others times people would come and they would hear the demons deriding him and mocking him and fighting with him. And some monks would flee in fear because the voices of the devils were so incredibly intense and vile, right? And there's one time where 2 monks tried to go down into the shaft with Anthony and they heard the voices of the devils. And they were so completely, utterly afraid, they cried out to Anthony. And Anthony was paying no attention to the voices of the devils. But he paid attention to when they cried for him. And Anthony said, you know, they appear to cowards. to try to scare them, right? And they make their voices known to cowards who try, and they try to scare them because they themselves are cowards, right? And he said, guard yourself with the sign of the cross and flee from this place, right? So they guarded themselves with the sign of the cross with boldness, and they fled from the place. So after this 20 years of solitude, they come and they break his door down and they ask him to come out finally, right? And so he comes out, and his appearance was just the same as before he went in, and his soul was unblemished. St. Athanasius says that he was not fat by staying in one place for too long, nor was he too skinny for fasting for such a long period of time. But he looked just the same, preserved as he did when he went in 20 years before. And he shone like light. Everybody was completely amazed. And St. Athanasius says he was abiding in a natural state. And this term, in a natural state, it means like Adam was before the fall. This is the natural state of man, to be completely purified of soul. And so when Athanasius says that he was abiding in a natural state, he means that he attained the sanctity that Adam had before the fall, right? And so we live in an unnatural state because of our condition to sin and the passions. St. Anthony had conquered them, and so he was living and abiding in a natural state. Some of the fathers call this state dispassion, in which the passions do not move the person anymore, right? The Mother of God had dispassion. She was still tempted by the devil, but she was never moved to act on them because she possessed dispassion. And so Anthony achieved this state of dispassion. And he was given the gift of speaking, of casting out demons and healing the sick. So he became a spiritual father to many. He began to enlist desert dwellers into the solitary life, and monks began to populate the desert around him. And this is about the year 305 when this started to happen. And so he was not prideful at the fact that people wanted him to be a spiritual father, nor was he angry that they had drug him from his solitude in his cave. So he spoke to them about his experiences in the desert, in solitude, and gave them tools to combat the devil through his own experiences. Most of the recorded advice from St. Anthony is documented in his address to monks. It's kind of like a little chapter, if you will, in the life of St. Anthony. It's absolutely gold. I mean, it's absolutely gold. He talks about how the devils would appear to him. He talks about solitude in the desert. He talks about discernment. He talks about, like, the origin of evil, right? That God did not create evil, and the devils exist in nothingness because they are evil, right? And so there's so much theology in it. There's so much theology in it. And so much treasure for the spiritual life in it. He talks about fortune tellers and how they get their advice from demons. And he explains it in a very simple way. You know, he says that for fortune tellers, for instance, he says, and whenever he explains these things, he always puts the devils to shame and mocks them somehow by the way that he talks. And he says, just as a messenger is going from one town to another, right? And the message needs to be changed. Or one person is going from one town to the other, and the first town wants the town that the person is going to, or the army or the messenger is going to be aware of the coming of these messengers or this army or this person. They will send a fleet-footed boy, he would say, right? Like someone who knows how to ride horseback or knows the ins and outs of the back ways to get to another place faster. Just as that person can get there faster than the army or the messengers in order to relay that the other person is coming, so do the demons do. He says, just as a fleet-footed boy would do, right? So they're able to pass messages quicker because they can travel quicker than we can, who are constrained by the flesh and this physical world, right? So This is how he explains, like, how fortune tellers, for instance, are able to talk about things from a person's past, or able to talk about things that are true in some respects, about a person's surroundings or about their life and things like that, just as a fleet-footed boy would do, he said, right, or could do, he says. So he talks about how the power of God over idols. He talks about spiritual deception. He talks about discernment. He talks about, you know, the deception of angels appearing in the guise of, demons appearing in the guise of angels, and things like that throughout this talk on his address to monks. It's incredibly powerful and very, very, very good. This is just some parts of it that I'll read to you. I didn't put it in the handout here because it's a long, they're long quotes, but you can read it in the life of St. Anthony in this chapter. He said, this is Anthony talking to his monks, right? He comes out once in a while and he addresses all of the monks. And so he says, "How often they have called me blessed, and I curse them in the name of the Lord. How often they predicted the rising of the river, and I answered them, 'What have you to do with it?' Once they came to me and surrounded me like soldiers in full armor. Another time they filled the house with horses, wild beasts, and creeping things, and I sang, 'Some in chariots, some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God.' And at the prayers, they were turned to flight by the Lord. Once they came in darkness, bearing the appearance of a light, and said, We are come to give thee light, O Antony.' But I closed my eyes and prayed, and immediately the light of the wicked one was quenched. And a few months after, they came as though singing songs and babbling words of scripture. But like a deaf man, I heard them not. Once they shook the cell with an earthquake, but I continued praying with unshaken heart. And after this, they came again, making noises, whistling and dancing. But as I prayed and lay singing psalms to myself, they forthwith began to lament and weep, as if their struggle had failed them. But I gave glory to the Lord, who had brought down and made an example of their daring and madness. Once a demon exceeding high appeared with pomp and dared to say, 'I am the power of God and I am providence. What dost thou wish, and I shall give it to thee?' But I then so much the more breathed upon him and spoke the name of Christ and set out to smite him. And I seemed to have smitten him, and forthwith he, as big as he was, together with all of his demons, disappeared at just the name of Christ. At another time, while I was fasting, he came full of craft under the semblance of another monk, with what seemed to be loaves, and gave me counsel, saying, 'Eat, and cease from thy many labors. Thou art a man, and art to fall sick.' But I, perceiving his device, rose up to pray, and he endured it not, for he departed. And through the door there seemed to go out, as it were, smoke. How often in the desert he has displayed what resembled gold, that I should only touch it and look upon it. But I sang psalms against him, and he vanished away. Often they would beat me with stripes, and I repeated again and again, 'Nothing shall separate me from the love of Christ.' And at this they were rather fell into beating one another. Nor was it that I stayed with them and destroyed their power, but it was the Lord who said, 'I beheld Satan as lightning fall from the heavens.' But I, children, mindful of the apostles' words, transfer this to myself, that you might not faint in discipline, nor to fear the devil or the delusions of the demons." Right? So, and this is a very small snippet of what he is talking about in his experiences with his monastics. He says, so much in this chapter on his address to monks that's very worthwhile. So in the life of St. Anthony in 311, under the persecution of Maximinus in Alexandria, he departed to the city to seek martyrdom. He wanted to be martyred, and he wanted his blood to be shed about these lives of Christians, that he was hearing about. So he left with a lot of his monks from his monastery in solitude in the desert and came into the city. He actually saw bands of Christians being led as prisoners and captives into the city, and he followed them with his monks, and they desired to have this martyrdom as well, to give witness. That's what martyr means, to give witness, a person that gives witness. And so he wanted to give this witness. And while he was there in Alexandria, he started to minister to Christians living in hiding, and those who were already in the prisons, making their resolution firm for martyrdom and teaching them not to be persuaded by the judges. And he also appeared in the courts and the judgment halls with boldness in defense of Christians, right? So in the judgment halls, you'd have people there to witness what was going on and the sentences that were being put upon the prisoners. And Anthony would go there with his monks, and he would shout out at the judges, and he would deride them, and he would stick up for the Christians. And the judges then ordered that all the monks were not allowed in courts, and they even ordered that they were not allowed in the city walls because of the boldness that they were given to Christians and the fear they struck in these judges. So they banned all monks from the cities. But St. Anthony didn't listen to the command. And not only didn't he listen to the command, but the next day after the command was made, he dressed in his best monastic apparel, and he appeared before the judge himself, wanting to be thrown in prison and wanting to be martyred. But the judge rode by him on his horse and ignored Anthony because he knew that Anthony was his bold person who wanted, right, the martyrdom, and he wanted his witness to be known. And these judges feared the people, that if they were to kill this man, this renowned Anthony, that people would turn on them or something bad would happen. So he never was able to receive the wreath of martyr that he wanted to. But nevertheless, he became a martyr spiritually. So Anthony, after this persecution, he departed and withdrew again to his cell into the desert, and was there daily a martyr of his conscience, Athanasius says, and contending in conflicts of faith, and his discipline was much severer, for he was ever fasting, and he had a garment of hair on the inside, while the outside was skin, which he kept until his end. And you read about this in Lives of Many of the Ascetics. They would, as an extra form of ascesis, would wear a hair shirt inside out. So the skin, the smooth part is on the outside, the hair, the itchy part, is on the inside. So they would wear these on purpose to make themselves uncomfortable, right? So they would give no luxury to the flesh, and they would begin to enter into this kind of battle, if you will, with themselves for luxury and for comfortability and things like that, so they can cast off their passions. So he wore this from this time into the end of his life, this garment of hair. And he neither bathed his body with water to free himself from filth, nor did he ever wash his feet, nor even endure so much as to put them into water, unless compelled by necessity. Nor did anyone even see him unclothed, nor his body naked at all, except after his death when he was buried. So he started to live a life of even greater asceticism. And after attracting the affection of pilgrims who came to him and populating the desert around him, Anthony sought to move deeper into the desert alone, and he found a mountain 3 days' journey away from the monastic cloister he had started, and secluded himself in what was called, until the end of his life, the inner mountain. So he found this mountain with a spring in it near the mouth of a cave, and he lived inside of this mountain, the inner mountain. And what happened later is that the monks who loved him so much and couldn't stand being away from him would start to come like once a month and like once a week, right? Like, and then finally started to like settle around him. And that was the outer mountain. The outer mountain, he had more disciples now living in the outer mountain. In his solitude, however, he did not stop from honoring the church, especially its bishops, its priests, and deacons. One thing about the life of St. Anthony, you can read about it is that even though he grew to such a high stature spiritually, whenever a monk from somewhere else visited, or a priest visited, or a bishop visited, a deacon visited, whatever it may be, he would put that person at the seat of honor in his monastic cloister, and he would ask him questions to try to learn from them. Right? So even to the end of his life, he was very humble, and he was still looking for that sweet nectar in every flower that he could find. Right? So even though he had been fed by angels, even though he had thwarted demons, even though that he had done all of these great works and populated the desert and all these kinds of things, he still knew that he could still learn and be profited spiritually by anyone, right? So he didn't just cast people off like, oh, I'm higher than, I've done this, I'm higher than that person, or, you know, that person doesn't know very much compared to me, right? Many of us have this kind of mentality sometimes. But a new person would come in, or especially if a clergy member would come in, he would sit down, he would ask them questions so that he can benefit from whatever they were saying to him. So he defended the church against the Arians and other heretics, right? So when Arianism and some other heresies rose in the church, he wrote letters about it. He talked about it. This is an unlearned man, right? In the world's eyes. But nevertheless, because he was so purified and living in this natural state as a state before the fall, so spiritually purified, that he was able to perceive the devices of the demons within these heresies and able to explain very, very high theology. And it wasn't because he knew theology by books. It's because he knew theology by experiencing God himself, right? So this is how the theologians in the early days fought these heresies. And his disciple, St. Athanasius the Great, who was one of his cell attendants and who Anthony loved so much as his disciple, later went on to be the great fighter against Arianism and Nestorianism, right? He became one of the greatest saints in the church, right? And he learned all of this stuff through his mentor, through St. Anthony. So at 105 years old, Anthony became sick and ordered two of his monks to bury him in secret so that his body would not be brought to the churches for reverence. He did not want his relics to be venerated. He did not want people to flock to him and basically make him a saint, right? He knew that this was a custom, but he did not want it to be done to him. He said, "I fled to the desert to flee the vanity of men. I do not want to be brought back so that men would come to me," you know? This was his humility. So he basically asked his attendants who care for him in his old age, to bury him in secret and never tell a word to anybody else. So that's what they did. They buried him in secret, and he asked for his garments to be divided, his monastic garment to be divided in two. And one was given to St. Athanasius the Great. Athanasius says he holds it like a great treasure. He'd keep it in a box, and he would look at it sometimes in order to inspire him with the life of his spiritual father, and to Saint Serapion, who's another saint in the church, and he was later became a bishop of like Lower Egypt. But after this, you know, when his face turned joyful, after he gave them kind of instructions, his last dying words, his face became joyful, and he departed this life. Saint Athanasius says that his feet moved like, as he was going to get up out of his bed, because he was running, like he wanted to run. You know, when he was in that moment between life and death, his soul wanted to run, like to the heavens, right? And so his body moved as if he was going to run joyfully and like meet and greet someone, right? So like if someone you loved came to your house, someone you haven't seen for a long time came to your house, you would jump up and run to them to embrace them. And so he was like the same way. When he saw the Lord coming and the angels coming, he jumped up to try to run and to embrace them, right? So this was how he ended his life. And later, you know, St. Anthony, he died And in the 4th century, his relics weren't uncovered until the 6th century during the reign of Emperor Justinian. We don't really know how it happened, but Synaxarion says it happened miraculously. There was some miracle in which his relics were revealed, just like we read today about St. John the Baptist's head, how it was revealed through these miracles and how they found it. The same thing with Anthony. His relics were revealed through a miracle. They were passed down and eventually made their way to France. And most of his relics were housed in France, and I believe still are there to this day, but I'm not 100% sure. I mean, we have relics in our churches around that have been given to us, you know, but this is before the schism. They were given to France, and actually they've been many times have healed people during plagues and stuff like that. His relics have been a source of healing during times of plagues. St. Anthony's legacy, though, is monumental for the church. I mean, there's really no end to his life and his teachings. There's really no end to it. We have so much of our tradition, you know, can go back to this man's legacy, his life, right? And he has rightly earned this title, the Father of Monks, because he was the first to teach, to live this life out in the desert. Remember, like I said last week, this wasn't the Cenobitic life, which we'll talk about next week. This was the life of the anchorite monk, the hermetic life, living as hermits. So they would live on their own in cloisters, and they would come together at times either for services or for, like this, for teachings. St. Anthony would teach his monks this way. But the way in which the West received monasticism was through St. Anthony as well, because Athanasius, his disciple, when he was put in exile twice, in 336 in Trier and in 340 in Rome, he brought a few desert dwelling monks with him. To Rome he brought Ammonius and Isidore, which knew St. Anthony. Actually, I don't know if they knew St. Anthony, but Athanasius nevertheless guided them, who knew St. Anthony, and brought them to Rome. And at first, like, the Romans, the Christians in Rome were, like, disgusted by these people. Like, they didn't know what this whole alien thing was of, like, living out in the desert, not bathing oneself, long hair, black robes, long beards, this kind of thing. They didn't know this way of life. But as they began to know St. Athanasius and who he was, and his great spiritual stature, right, that the West began to embrace the monastic life. And wherever he went, he gave the teaching of St. Anthony. And this life of St. Anthony the Great, in the prologue to it, he tells why he wrote it. And he wrote it so that all the monasteries who have been asking him over and over about who Anthony was, and how he began his life, and how he ended his life, and how he taught his monks, and how he lived as a monk, and all this kind of stuff. He wrote it for the specific purpose, so that these letters would be distributed from monastery to monastery, and they would be able to emulate this way of St. Anthony's life, and be able to benefit, just as the monks around him benefited from his life. But that's how the West got monasticism. Athanasius brought it from St. Anthony. So, that's the life of St. Anthony the Great, the father of monks. We'll hearken back to his life many times during the course of talking about, you know, the flowers of the desert, the monks of the desert. And next week, we'll talk about St. Pachomius the Great, St. Macarius the Great, and the Cenobitic monastic life. All right, so...